imagine. There was no time to react. At the pinnacle of my full extension across the table, with a plate full of prime rib, out came the most impressive and lengthy gassing you could ever imagine. I hardly had time to regret the Mexican food I'd eaten earlier. This was terrible in its own right, but what was even more remarkable is that it went on forever. I could have sounded out the alphabet if I could have gotten my hands back there, and no amount of butt-tightening would have put an end to it. As I finished my episode, looks of absolute shock from my guest came into focus. I think I heard a woman scream. I certainly had caught the attention of the surrounding tables. A hushed silence descended on all of us, and I just stood there, paralyzed, holding the prime rib high over the table. I didn't know what to say, and I was afraid that any movement might set off another aftershock. Finally, one of the men got up, threw the napkin I'd placed in his lap on the table, and walked straight to the maitre d'. With punishing accuracy, I saw him describe what just went down, acting out my full extension as he stood on one foot and leaned across an imaginary table. The sounds he tried to recount lacked a certain bass tone and texture, but overall I think he got the general idea and duration right. I was fired on the spot. No kidding. With my cummerbund in one hand and bow tie in the other, I walked back to my VW Bug with my head hung low. I sat in the front seat, took a deep breath, and wondered what I was supposed to feel at a time like this. On the one hand, I just destroyed a year's worth of work. I'd earned that waiter spot playing in the minor leagues, bussing tables, and when I finally stepped up to the plate in the major leagues, I swung as hard as I could and hit the umpire in the back of the head. I don't know how I could have messed up any worse, to be honest. Yet on the other hand, I had a story for the ages, a story I could someday tell my kids when they thought they had made a big mistake. I took in another deep breath and felt this huge grin spreading across my face. The grin was almost happening to me rather than me making it happen. As I drove home, I recounted the events of the last hour or two. I thought about my now useless tuxedo, the guests, the order, the infamous extension, the gasps, the screams, the firing. I can't lie. I knew even then it had indeed been an amazing, if not flawless, night. My grandmother, Grandma Mary, used to tell me, "You're nothing until you've been fired once or twice." She didn't give any disclaimers for how you got fired, so I assumed her adage still applied to me. For the next 6 months, I made payments on that tux until I dropped it off at Goodwill, and I never tried my hand as a waiter again. The thing I love about God is he intentionally guides people into failure. He made us to be born as little kids who can't walk or talk or even use the bathroom correctly. We have to be taught everything. All that learning takes time, and he made us so we would be dependent on him, our parents, and each other. The whole thing is designed so we'll try again and again until we finally get it right, and the whole time, he is endlessly patient. I love those passages in Scripture where Jesus teaches the disciples something, saying, "I want to teach you to think differently about life." They walked with him for years, and some of them didn't learn everything they needed to know until after he'd gone back to heaven. Yet even though they were slow to learn, they still referred to themselves as his beloved. Failure is just part of the process, and it's not just okay, it's better than okay. God doesn't want failure to shut us down. God didn't make it a three strikes and you're out sort of thing. It's more about how God helps us dust ourselves off so that we can swing for the fences again. And all of this without keeping a meticulous record of all of our screw-ups. I found another job eventually, and eventually lost that one too. But I lost it because I chose to that time, not because I was fired. Finding things and losing things is what the Bible is all about. God even seemed to encourage it. He talked about losing your job, or even your life, if you wanted to find it. He talked about losing your status to find real power. He shows that Jesus comes looking for us because people, like sheep, have a knack for getting lost. And when he finds us, we're usually not dressed up in a tux. Things that go wrong can shape us or scar us. I've had some things go well in my life and some things not go well, just like you. More have gone well than have gone poorly, but I'm not trying to keep score because I have a different way I measure those things now. God finds us in our failures and our successes, and he says that while we used to think one way about things, now he wants us to think another way about those same things. And for me, I've realized that I used to be afraid of failing at the things that really mattered to me. But now, I'm more afraid of succeeding at things that don't matter. Chapter 6. Go buy your books. I used to think God guided us by opening and closing doors. But now, I know sometimes God wants us to kick some doors down. When I told my parents I was applying to law school, they looked at me like I was proposing to remove my own liver. You have to understand, my parents are both educators. I wasn't the smartest kid growing up. I'd bring home my grades and they'd look at me wondering how the pear fell so far from the apple tree. When I graduated from high school, they gave me brochures for vocational schools that taught courses on engines and electronics and plumbing. I think they pictured me installing low-voltage landscape lighting for the rest of my life. I did too. I got into college and graduated with a degree in something I still know little about, and my grades reflected my wafer-thin understanding of the subject matter. It wasn't that I didn't try hard in college. I was just bored and searching for a good match for my particular wiring harness. I wanted to do things that would make a difference in the world. My professors, however, wanted me to do things that would make a difference in my grade point average. I spent most of college surfing and trying to figure out how I could help people in crisis here and abroad and make some kind of lasting contribution to the world. I didn't want to be a pastor or a missionary. I knew that God had better people set aside for that. So I decided that I was going to be a lawyer. I know a lot of people think you can't love God and be a nice guy and still be a lawyer, but I was betting I could. There's a big test called the LSAT you need to take before applying to law schools. All the schools look at your score on the test and then decide if they'll let you in. I knew the test was important, so I bought a paperback book on the LSAT at the local bookstore. It was about an inch thick and cost me $7.95, and I read it cover to cover at least 3 times before signing up for the exam. The book was an easy read, and it seemed simple enough. Most of the book was on how you sign up for the test. When the big day for the exam arrived, I got to the test site an hour early. This was my shot at law school. The people sitting around me ranged from well-coiffed prep school types to late-night procrastinators still in their pajamas. Regardless of their outward appearance, though, everyone asked what review class I had taken to prepare for the LSAT. Did you take the Princeton review, or was it Barbary? I heard 4 or 5 names of 2-month-long review courses and estimated that the average height of prep materials everyone had was about 5 feet tall. It was apparent that I was woefully unprepared, and my glazed-over look gave me away. "Hey, dude, are you okay?" one of the test takers said, assuming a surfer guy persona because it probably seemed like the only way he could break through to me. "Review class? There's a class you can take to prepare for this test?" was all I could choke out. I looked down at my measly, dog-eared prep book, a mere 105 pages, and sighed as I threw it in the nearby trash can. Since I already paid the money, I went ahead and took the test. Weeks later, suffice it to say, I got the inevitable news. The LSAT crushed me. Despite the headwinds I was facing, I sent my applications to several law schools, you know, to give the admissions office a chuckle and break the monotony of sizing up the real law student candidates. I felt like I was basically making a small donation to each law school I applied to in the form of an application fee. I got lots of mail over the next few months, brimming with lovely politeness that all ended, "No." I get that a lot. The really smart kids got letters back from the good law schools welcoming them and sometimes even giving them scholarships to sweeten their offers. The medium smart kids got regular admissions from the regular law schools, and the just plain smart kids got put on waiting lists. I got none of the above. From anyone. I think some of the schools didn't write back because they figured we both just kind of knew. Some rejection letters I received even returned my application check. Either they didn't have the heart to take my money knowing I had zero chance of getting in, or they figured that with my low score, I should save every penny I had. There was one problem with this, though. You see, I wanted to be a lawyer so I could make an impact in the world, which meant I had to graduate from law school. With no defensible case for admission anywhere, I still decided I wouldn't take no for an answer. I knew the law school I wanted to attend. So, about a week before classes started, I went over to the great big hall where the dean's office and admission staff were. I introduced myself at the front desk, and they seemed pleased to meet the person who had been phoning them incessantly to confirm that indeed he really didn't get in. I walked to the dean's large office door, knocked, and sheepishly entered the austere room covered with bookshelves and intelligence. The dean of the law school stood up and greeted me with a reserved but polite formality that fit his position and title. I shoved my hand forward, confidently, like they say in the books to do, and introduced myself. "Hello, I'm Bob Goff, and I applied to get into your law school," I said. "I applied because I want to be a lawyer and make a real difference in the world." The dean smiled politely, didn't say a word, and remained standing. Apparently, this wasn't enough to convince him. There's a problem, however. You see, I didn't get an acceptance letter. For that matter, I didn't even get a rejection letter. I didn't get put on a waiting list either. But I want to get into your law school and graduate, or I can't be a lawyer someday. I thought I had framed my situation pretty well. The dean shook my hand again and said, "This is a competitive program, and unfortunately, we have to turn down many qualified applicants." Mercifully, he skipped the part about me not being one of them. "It was nice to meet you," he said, still shaking my hand. Once he broke his grasp, he put his hand on my shoulder and started moving me towards the door. His body language left nothing to be misinterpreted. "I hope you have a nice day," he offered as he began to slowly close the door. I had the chance to say one last thing before the dean disappeared into his paneled office. So I stopped the closing door with my foot and said, "You have the power to let me in. I know all you have to tell me is, go buy your books, and I could be a student at the law school. It's that simple. You just need to say those words." He gave me half a grin, indicating he thought it was a cute idea, but it wasn't going to happen. Then the door closed. I'm sure he thought he had finished with me and could go on with the important business of training the law students who actually had potential. There was a bench in front of the dean's office. It reminded me of the bench I frequently warmed at the principal's office during elementary school. There were 5 days left before law school started, and I decided I would park myself on that bench every day. Every time he passed by, I would say to the dean, "All you have to say is go buy your books." It was a last-ditch plan from a determined surfer. The first time the dean walked by, he asked me why I was still there. I told him that while I understood they had turned down my application, I also knew he could tell me to go buy my books. I knew he had the power to let me in. All he had to do was say the words, "Go get your books." He smiled at me and walked away. I had a lot of time to think, sitting on my bench, day in, day out. I thought about instances in the Bible where all it took was saying the word to make it happen. Jesus would say a word and people would be healed. Or he'd just say, "Come," to a guy named Peter, and that guy ended up walking on water for heaven's sake. There was even a time when Jesus was on his way to a soldier's house to heal a servant, but the soldier said all Jesus had to do was say the word and the ailing servant would be better. As I sat on my bench, I believed words still had power when they're said by the right people. With 4 days to go before law school started, I was back at my bench, bright and early in the morning. Every time the dean passed in or out of his office, I would say, "Just tell me to buy my books." He'd just nod, sometimes shake his head, and sometimes completely ignore me and walk away. The same thing occurred 3 days, 2 days, and then one day to go before law school started. I had missed the 60s, but I still felt like this was a sit-in and I was part of it. By the third or fourth day on the bench, I knew everything about the dean's schedule. I knew when he took his bathroom breaks, his daily meetings, when he left for the gym, and when he returned. Every time he darkened the door of his office, I'd be sitting there, smiling and waiting for him to say the words, words that would change everything for me. At dawn on the day law school started, I sprang out of bed. I just knew this was going to be the big day for me. At 7 o'clock in the morning, I was on the appointed bench. I watched all the smart kids arrive, bustling around and sizing each other up. Their high-functioning din ricocheted off the marble walls and columns. I sat there eager to hear the words, but I didn't even see the dean the entire day. I was dejected. My plan to make it into law school before opening day hadn't worked, so I took a lap around the halls and decided, if I couldn't make it into law school before it started, I'd just get in after it started and catch up. The dean passed by at least a dozen times in the course of the second day. "Just tell me to buy my books," I'd say each time. And each time, nothing. Day two of law school ended, as did day three. I was falling behind at law school and I wasn't even admitted. Day four, still nothing. On day five, for the first time, my hope was starting to crater as I dragged myself to my perch. All the smart kids had settled into their routines and the rigors of law school, and the only noises that echoed off the walls in the large marbled hall were mine. I mused in my boredom about what it would be like if I brought my Fender Stratocaster in and played a couple of my favorite Doobie Brothers riffs. I decided I'd save that for graduation day. Late in the afternoon, I heard the familiar footfall of the dean walking towards the door. I glanced at my watch. This was a little early for him to be leaving, but a little late for his mid-afternoon bathroom break. There was nothing about this guy's schedule I didn't know, and then the footsteps stopped. Without a lot of fanfare, the dean turned the corner from his office, and as usual, I prepared to say, "Just tell me to buy my books." Something was different this time, though, because instead of avoiding me and walking away without saying anything, the dean just stood there, towering over me. There was a long pause. The dean looked at me squarely in the eyes, gave me a wink, and then said four words that changed my life forever. "Go buy your books." And I did. I once heard somebody say that God had closed a door on an opportunity they were hoping for. But I've always wondered if, when we want to do something that we know is right and good, God places that desire deep in our hearts because he wants it for us and it honors him. Maybe there are times when we think a door has been closed and, instead of misinterpreting that circumstance, God wants us to kick it down. Or perhaps just sit outside of it long enough until someone tells us we can come in. Words can launch us. We don't need to be a dean to say words that change everything for someone. Instead, God made it so that ordinary people, like you and me, can launch each other. In fact, I wonder if we can launch people better than a dean because we're ordinary. I believe it's true that the right people can say words that can change everything. And guess what? We're the ones that can say them. It's been a number of years since I sat on that dean's bench trying to get into law school. These days, I do a number of things, but one of them is to serve as an adjunct professor at Pepperdine Law School, where I get to teach nonprofit law to some fantastic law students. They're the really smart kids who got the letters that said yes. Now I'm the one who gets to speak words of life and encouragement to them. I get a chuckle when I pass by the dean's office on the way to teach a class, and I think about a different dean's office I sat in front of at a different law school, hoping for the chance to be a lawyer someday. Every time I get a chance, I find a student who's hoping to get into my class, but the school didn't let them in for some reason. And without a lot of fanfare, I find where they are sitting and stop. I look them squarely in the eyes, give them a wink, and tell them, "Go buy your books." Chapter 7. Sweet Maria. I used to think Jesus motivated us with ultimatums, but now I know he pursues us in love. Do you remember falling in love the first time? I do. I was a Young Life leader in college along with my buddy Doug. Young Life is an outfit that does a great job with high school kids introducing them to Jesus of Nazareth without making it a big religious deal. A girl just out of college named Maria came to help Doug and me because we didn't have any college-age women leaders. I was standing up in front playing songs on the guitar when Maria walked into the room. When I saw her, I immediately broke a string, leaned over and whispered to Doug, "That's Mrs. Goff." I asked Maria later what she remembers about that night, and she says she doesn't remember whispering anything to anyone about me. If Jesus has taught me anything, though, it's that sometimes you can really want to know somebody, and it takes them forever to want to know you back. The day I saw Maria was 10 days before Valentine's Day, and since I had already secretly claimed her as my bride, I figured I'd better let her get to know me. You know that feeling where you don't know what to do with yourself? Everything reminds you of that person. A painting, a sunset, children playing, a couple holding hands, a paperclip, my wristwatch, everything. Yet thinking about them just isn't enough. You just need to do something, anything. Maria worked at an advertising agency on the 12th floor of a high-rise office building downtown. I had known Maria for a whole week and a half, so I did the most sensible thing I could think of. I made her a huge Valentine's Day card. I got two huge sheets of 4-foot by 8-foot cardboard and glued the edges together, a perfect envelope. I made a stamp the size of a doormat and put it on the envelope upside down. Guys, you know that means I love you, right? If not, back to finishing school for you. Inside, I took another 4-foot by 8-foot sheet of cardboard and wrote, Maria, will you be my Valentine? Simple, straightforward, not too hard to spell. I really wanted to write, Maria, will you marry me? But it would have been a little early. Proposals are definitely week 3 material. I borrowed a guy's truck and drove my gigantic car downtown and into the parking garage of the high-rise. I struggled to get the car into the elevator and drew more than a few odd looks and smiles. The elevator sped me upward. I felt so excited I thought I was going to faint. But I didn't want to crumple the card, so I pulled myself together. Wouldn't Maria think this is just about the greatest Valentine's Day card she's ever received? Wouldn't she know how nuts I was about her? Wouldn't she like me back? This was going to be just great. She's going to love it. The elevator slowed to a stop, and the bell sounded as the doors opened. It took me a while to get the card out of the elevator. The bell started ringing more urgently. It probably sounded like someone had installed a Vegas-style slot machine next to the emergency phone, but it was just me struggling to get the card out of the elevator. Word must have spread in the office about the guy with a big card stuck in the elevator because, within a few seconds, a small crowd gathered in the lobby. I heard them wonder out loud if they should get the fire department to bring the jaws of life to get me out. Once I got clear of the doors, the small gaggle stared at me like I was wearing diving gear. Fins, snorkel, scuba tank, the whole bit. For the first time, I started thinking that maybe this wasn't such a good idea. But it was too late. After being paged, Maria came around the corner and saw me standing there with a big dumb grin, floppy ears, and a gigantic, overambitious card. I don't think a group of guys stomping out Riverdance behind me would have been much more of a shock to her. Maria was absolutely mortified. It set our courtship back about 6 months, bare minimum. During the next 6 months, I was trigger-locked on Maria while she treated me with a polite distance. She would barely talk to me, and I was told, hopefully with a good dose of sarcasm, that the sight of cardboard made her run. But I was undaunted, despite the fact that a column of smoke was still rising from smoldering embers where I crashed and burned on Valentine's Day. I didn't quite know what to do with myself, but I had to do something to express what I was feeling inside. Then I remembered. I knew where she parked her car. I decided to start each day by making Maria a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I put it under the windshield wiper of her car. Why? Well, I'm not quite sure. It was like I was sandwich stalking her. Sometimes I would even put notes in the sandwiches. I know all this sounds crazy, but if you got to know me, I bet you wouldn't think so. Maria probably thought I was weird. But weird can be safe, too, and my love was a weird, safe love. Fortunately, Maria understood that for some of us, most of us, the language of love is laced with whimsy. It sometimes borders on the irrational. Like I've been saying, though, love is a do thing. It's an energy that has to be dissipated. I lived in a beach house in San Diego during law school. It was more like a shack, actually. It was next to a laundromat, and a couple of us homely-looking guys lived together and split cheap rent. There was a house across the alley from us that was often rented by female Young Life leaders, so I angled for Maria to get a room. It turned out that the three of us homely guys in our house were interested in the three beautiful girls in their house. Eventually, each of the guys married each of the girls, one apiece. No kidding, it just so happened that whatever girl slept on the bottom bunk at their house was always the next girl to get married to one of us. Looking back, I wish I had snuck in and made the other mattresses a little less comfortable, because Maria never seemed to want to move into that bottom bunk. I suspected that she had seen the trend and perhaps opted to sleep on the couch or floor rather than risk ending up with me. During the time that I was trying to get Maria to notice me, I was studying for the bar exam. She would come over to say hello, and I would be curled up in the fetal position. Toward the end of law school, the professor told us to look around because every third person in the row wouldn't pass the exam. No matter which end of the row I started counting from, I was always the third guy. I'm not one for superstition or anything, but there was a real sense of portent in the seating arrangement. Never mind that I'd been studying for 3 years. Adding to the pressure, I didn't want to ask Maria to marry me unless I had passed the bar exam. I'm not sure why this was a self-imposed prerequisite. I guess I didn't want her stuck with a guy who constantly mumbled about how the seventh time's the charm while duplicating keys in a parking lot kiosk. What made it worse is that my roommate Kevin was the top student at the law school and was about the smartest guy in the whole world. His girl couldn't wait for him to pop the question. No one seemed to be wondering how the bar exam would work out for Kevin. I, on the other hand, was scanning the want ads as a fallback. Somehow I squeaked by the California bar exam the first time. It was finally time to ask Sweet Maria to marry me. I arranged to borrow someone's brand new $500,000 yacht. I hatched a plan to sail to a secluded place where Maria and I would take my tiny thrash sailboats and read books together. Books she'd bought us about friendship, actually. By now, I sensed that Maria was either overcome with pity or was actually starting to like me. She probably also intuited that if she married someone else, I'd likely live under her house just to be near her. She must have decided that liking me back would be less complicated and less creepy. I decorated the yacht with a rainbow's worth of colored crepe paper, and then it started raining. The rainstorm hit with a vengeance, drenching my proposal plans and leaving the brand new sailboat with colors smeared across the deck and hull like a very expensive tie-dye t-shirt. I didn't spend the day proposing to Maria and dreaming about a life together. I spent it scrubbing soggy colored disappointment off some guy's boat. Although my first plan had imploded, I was still going to get the girl. I had an idea. There was a turn-of-the-century building next to the Hotel Del Coronado, and the roof was enclosed by this thing called a widow's walk. It was more of an architectural feature, really, but to me it created a tiny rooftop restaurant, one that was 8 feet by 8 feet. Layers of dust, broken chairs, old napkins, and outdated menus were strewn about. But I had high hopes for it. I described my failed boat caper and floundering marriage proposal dreams to the building owner. The guy could see how desperate I was, and I was doing my best to look forlorn, which wasn't hard. So he let me move the chairs and set up a small table, 2 chairs, and some candlesticks in the tiny room. Later that night, as the storm raged outside, I led Maria up to the little room I had readied. When Maria and I were finished with dinner, I got down on one knee and asked, "Maria, will you?" Then the emotion of the moment was just too much for me, and I couldn't talk anymore. As has been one of Sweet Maria's outstanding characteristics ever since, she helped me finish what I had started and said yes. These days, I continue to tell Sweet Maria that I'm much more experienced at loving her than she is at loving me, because among other things, I've been at it a couple years longer than she has been. She usually teases me about the lame Valentine's Day card and asks me what in the world I was thinking with the sandwiches under her windshield wipers each morning. I love my wife very much, and I always will. For the past 25 years, she's been my muse. My love for her and her love for me is the fire that warms our family. But the reason I wanted to tell you this story is that it has to do with another thing I've learned following Jesus. Because God made me to love Maria, and because God made it so I had to convince her to love me back, he gave me a very real way to understand what's happening in the universe. Because of our love for each other, I understand just a little more how God has pursued me in creative and whimsical ways, ways that initially did not get my attention. Nevertheless, he wouldn't stop. That's what love does. It pursues blindly, unflinchingly, and without end. When you go after something you love, you'll do anything it takes to get it, even if it costs everything. Maria and I spend our summers in a beautiful part of British Columbia. We've built a house on the water so people who are tired or who need to work something out can come and find some rest. The house is at the end of an inlet that might be one of the most beautiful places on earth. And one of my favorite things to do in the inlet is to take a boat back to a place called Chatterbox Falls. To get there, you have to go through a fjord with rock cliffs jutting up from the water thousands of feet on both sides until they disappear beneath huge white glaciers. There's a mountain, too, a beautiful mountain called One Eye. You can see it on your left as you race across the water to Chatterbox. Sometimes we go right by it, and I don't pay any attention. But other times it strikes me with a power that causes me to stop the boat and stare in amazement. To me, it's proof that God loves us and pursues us and does things to get our attention, by giving me my mind to perceive beauty, and then wooing me with the beauty of that fjord and that mountain. I've seen mountains with peaks that look like the head of a horse, and others that look like eagle wings stretched out in flight. But to me, when I stop, amazed once again at the ways God loves and pursues us, and kind of squint a little, one eye looks a lot like a guy getting out of an elevator with a giant Valentine's Day card. Chapter 8. Wedding Cake. I used to think being a believer was enough, but now I know Jesus wants us to participate no matter what condition we're in. When I got married, we didn't have any money at all. I was just out of law school and was volunteering as a young life leader at one of the local high schools. I think after I sold my rusty Volkswagen, we had about $3 to spend for each person who was coming to the wedding, maybe less. We didn't get many flowers. Instead, we got a lot of balloons, and we found a caterer who felt sorry enough for us to give us some food for cheap. The cake was going to be a big problem, though. Sweet Maria had checked around, and a cake was going to cost more than we had for the whole wedding. Then I remembered there was a kid in Young Life whose dad owned a bakery. I asked how big of a cake I could get for about $150, and he said he could make one that would be about 4 stories tall. That would do. The wedding went as weddings do. I said I do, she said I do, and we ran down the aisle. The reception was held at a very swanky clubhouse on the lake of Fairbanks Ranch. In order to live at Fairbanks Ranch, I think you need to have invented medicine or energy or something. I was a young lawyer, and my boss had purchased a home in the area. With the purchase came the right to use the clubhouse on the lake twice a year, for free. That was just inside our price range. My boss was a generous guy and secured the venue, and we showed up with our bags of balloons, the caterer, and the pasta salad. Because we couldn't afford much in terms of food to serve, we had the caterers put up a lot of props that couldn't be eaten, but made it look like it was quite a feast. Big loaves of bread, a huge cheese wheel, lingered just out of reach and towered like mountains over our pasta salad. When we got to the reception, I saw my high school-age friend had already arrived from the bakery with the cake. What caught my eye was that he was assembling the 4-story cake on top of an AV cart in the parking lot. Is that how it's done, I wondered? He had put all the pillars in place and was already assembling the 3rd floor of our white skyscraper as we parked. It looked very impressive as he continued to assemble it in the parking lot like he was building downtown all over again. He had everything up except a crane, scaffolding, and road cones. I was walking my new bride towards the entrance of the reception as he carefully put the bride and groom ornaments on the pinnacle of his masterpiece. The happy plastic couple towered above the parking lot as they surveyed all that was theirs below them. They would certainly not be eaten at the reception, and they stood with a confidence that comes with knowing that. As my young friend started wheeling the high-rise cake towards the clubhouse on the AV cart, its wobbling back left wheel somehow drew attention to what a bad idea it was. Then predictably, as if it was unfolding in slow motion, the cart hit a small rock and abruptly stopped. But the upper levels of the cake didn't. In rapid succession, each layer of the cake fell off its pillars and headed towards the parking lot. 3 splats later, most of our wedding cake was lying on the asphalt in a pile. We all just kind of stood there without speaking, looking at the pile of cake in stunned silence, the bride and groom ornaments laying silently on top, looking like they had just lost a massive food fight. Calling for some quick thinking as the guests were about to arrive at any minute, I pulled my shell-shocked young baker aside between 2 cars, and we hatched a plan. He scooped the cake together and jumped back in his well-used Subaru. 30 minutes later, he was back with a bucket of shredded cake and an even bigger bucket of freshly made icing from the bakery. In the back room, he iced the shards of cake back into shape, restacked it, and yes, I'm a little embarrassed to say, we served it up. Gravel, small bits of asphalt, and all. Like that cake, my life is full of small rocks, pieces of asphalt, broken and unrepaired relationships, and unwanted debris. But somehow, God allows us each to be served up anyway. Jesus talked to social outcasts, loose women, lawyers like me, and religious people, and said they would not just be so many decorations or window treatments, but he would serve them up as well. He said this was true even though we're full of the kind of grit that accumulates over the span of a life, and quite a few parking lots. The only thing that Jesus said he wouldn't serve up were people who were full of themselves or believed the lie that they were who they used to be before they met him. Jesus seemed to say that all we would need to do is to scrape together the pieces of our lives that had fallen on the ground, bring those pieces to him, and he would start using them. Jesus didn't say he would ice over the grit or faults or failures either. He said he would use us in spite of the grits and faults and failures. What we would have to do is to decide to move from the parking lot to the party. And he said we can't do that by just believing all the right stuff anymore. Jesus said he'd help us start doing the right stuff. At some point, I stopped staring at the pile of broken cake on the asphalt that was my life and decided to get some skin in the game. My life had not been shattered into many pieces by a massive tragedy, but it consisted of as many disorganized pieces as it would have if it had been. I simply decided that I wasn't going to let the residual rocks and small pieces of gravel get in the way of me getting served up and used. It has always seemed to me that broken things, just like broken people, get used more. It's probably because God has more pieces to work with. Jesus talked about lawyers a lot, too. None of it was very flattering, actually. He usually lumped lawyers in with liars and people who didn't speak the truth. Jesus said that they were getting in the way of people knowing God, which is a really bad thing. He said the same thing about religious people, too, sometimes in the same sentence. But he also talked about everyone else, and what he said to them is that we all could be used, not just when we're broken, but especially because we're broken. I've tried to build a few things in my life. I took what I thought were great ideas, I stacked them neatly on pillars, put them on my AV card, and I rolled them out. I've hit my share of rocks, too, and those rocks have sent parts of my dreams hurling. Yet Jesus continues to select broken and splattered people, not just as followers, but as participants. He called people like me, who can't even figure out which end of a plastic bag to open, his hands. He called people who trip every day, his feet. He called people who can't figure out which way to turn a screw to tighten it, or even to stack a cake correctly, the ones who would build a kingdom. And then, if we're willing, he serves us up. Rocks, small bits of asphalt, and all. Chapter 9. Just say yes. I used to think you had to be special for God to use you, but now I know you simply need to say yes. I love playing practical jokes on my buddies. My friend Doug made the big mistake of telling me one time where he was going to celebrate his 10th wedding anniversary. He had rented the penthouse suite of a fancy hotel and was going to surprise his bride with an overnight stay. It was way too tempting for me not to come up with a prank. A few days later, Sweet Marie and I went to the fancy hotel and checked in as if we were Doug and his wife. I walked up to the clerk at the front desk and confidently said I was Doug and wanted to know if our room was ready. The room was prepaid, so they tossed me the key and asked me if there was anything they could do for me. I told them there indeed was, and I'd be calling down from the room soon. I had a list. Sweet Marie and I skipped to the elevator that rocketed us up to the top floor of the hotel to a huge pair of doors. We each grabbed a handle and turned at the same time. We were greeted by a magnificent room, the kind that a professional interior decorator had dressed up from top to bottom. On the far side of the room was a wall of windows with a stunning view of the city on one side and the bay on the other. It was a spectacular view, and the room was enormous. I think it must have had its own zip code. I picked up the phone, which went straight to the front desk, and we ordered room service. We had lobster for the first course. For dinner, lightly sautéed vegetables over rice and salmon. For dessert, actually, I'm not sure what the dessert was, but the table server set it on fire. It was so cool we ordered seconds. We turned on some beautiful music and danced. We laughed. We had them send up more ice cream, just because we could. After we finished soaking in the panoramic views and the last of the plates had been cleared, we signed the waiter up for a big tip, tidied up the room, and we split. When Doug and his wife checked into the hotel several hours later, they were led up to their magnificent room by a slightly confused but compliant bellman. Hadn't they already checked in? What a fantastic night they had, I'm told. The next day, when Doug went to check out, the concierge slid the bill across the counter. Doug's eyes popped when he saw a $400 room service bill. From our house the next morning, I was imagining what must have been his futile protest over and over in my head as I smiled. Hey, wait, I didn't order room service. I didn't order seconds. Extra ice cream? I would never leave that big of a tip. Then the nickel must have dropped when he realized I had pranked him as he groaned under his breath, Bob. Doug's been trying to get me back for years, but he can't because I'm a lawyer. You don't get into and through law school like I did without gaining a few street smarts. A few years later, however, I received a phone call from a fellow who introduced himself through a heavy accent as the ambassador from Uganda. I immediately thought, yeah, right, and you have my home phone number. I knew it had to be Doug, or someone he'd put up to the task. I listened intently as the caller spoke and I played along. So, Bob, I'm aware of what you've been doing in Uganda over the past several years with the children in the jails and with the judiciary. I'm very pleased and I want to thank you on behalf of the president. In fact, I'm so pleased that I want to know if you'd consider something. I couldn't wait to hear what it was that Doug had cooked up. I want to know if you'll be counsel for the Republic of Uganda. Counsel? I thought. Uganda needs a lawyer? Why? Does someone owe you money? And why would you want me to be their lawyer anyway? No matter. This was just Doug's weak attempt to get even for the hotel incident. I covered the phone and whispered to Sweet Maria, it's Doug. He's trying to play a prank on me. I'll tell you more in a second, but you're going to hear me say yes a lot, okay? Yes after yes left my lips, and the conversation ended with Doug, or his hired gun, saying he was leaving for Uganda and would call me back in about 2 months when he returned. Yes, of course, I replied. Have a nice trip. Great to talk to you. Say hello to everyone from me. The next 2 months were busy and passed in a blink. I hadn't given much thought to Doug's call, and I kind of figured that his joke had gone its course. And then the phone rang again. The caller introduced himself again as the ambassador from Uganda. Through his thick accent, which was a spot-on match to the voice from the first call, he said, Bob, I only have a few minutes. I want you to know that you need to meet me in New York on Saturday. I remembered that I decided to say yes no matter how outlandish the request was. New York? Yes, you bet. I was feeling some moxie and said, I was hoping you'd ask. See you there. The person with the accent gave me the address of one of the nicer hotels in Manhattan. I was in for an adventure, for sure, but to drop everything and hop on a plane, all to make a friend feel like we were even, it was a lot to concede, even for me. But a yes is a yes, so off I went. When I got off the plane at Kennedy Airport a few days later and headed downtown to the hotel, I was thinking, I may have gotten Doug for a $400 lobster dinner, but he's gotten me back and then some. Look at me. I just flew across the country to New York so I could supposedly be Uganda's lawyer. I shook my head and quietly chuckled as the taxi driver drove me into the city. Getting out of the cab at the hotel, I fully expected to pick up a note card in the lobby from Doug that said, "You came all this way. Go ahead and get the lobster. It's on me." I was milling about the hotel lobby and saw an entourage pull up with little Ugandan flags waving from the headlights. Then several members of Uganda's government strode into the lobby. I hadn't even considered that this could be real, so I was shocked. I hesitated even identifying myself, and I thought I could slip out the back to the airport unnoticed. Ambassador Kamununwari came bouncing up. I'm Ambassador Kamununwari. Of course you are, I replied as I gave him a hug. The ambassador was a jolly, brilliant, and affable man who looked to be in his late 50s. He had a heavy yet wonderfully British accent, as do most Ugandans. He isn't the kind of guy who walks, he gallops. He has the swagger of a high school quarterback and the smile of a pastor. He was the kind of guy you instantly feel like you've known for years. The ambassador gathered the dignitaries from Uganda around him and with one arm around my shoulder introduced me. This is our new consul for the Republic of Uganda. Consul? I laughed out loud. You said you wanted me to be counsel, you know, lawyer, right? The ambassador didn't skip a beat. He let out another one of his jolly laughs. No, Bob, I said consul, not counsel. We want you to be a diplomat representing the Republic of Uganda to the United States. He continued, I've got the paperwork all completed. All you need to do is give me a couple passport pictures and I'll submit it to Uganda's parliament for approval. I did what I told Sweet Maria I'd do every time he asked me to do something. I said yes. 4 months passed without any further updates, but then word came from the Parliament of Uganda that I had been approved for appointment. I got a call shortly thereafter from someone with a stern voice, the kind of voice that doesn't approve of monkey business and wears dark blue suits. It was the State Department informing me that the customary FBI background check was being done on my file. I have a file? How cool is that? Apparently, all of my misdeeds must have been overlooked, and I was approved by the State Department for appointment as consul for the Republic of Uganda to the United States. My diplomatic credentials were issued within weeks, and my family and I planned for the big ceremony. At this point, someone told me about the perks of being a diplomat. First, I would get some really cool license plates. With those, I can literally park anywhere. On the sidewalks, on the grass, on the second base of Fenway Park, in your garage, wherever. Second, I get a set of Ugandan flags to put on my car. I pictured those diplomatic license plates and a couple Ugandan flags on my ride. Sweet! Finally, and definitely the coolest part, is that you get a card from the State Department that gives you diplomatic immunity. I wasn't exactly sure what diplomatic immunity meant, so I asked around to see if I could kill someone. Not someone important, of course, but someone normal, like Doug. I never got a call back on that question, so I'm operating under the assumption that I can. I think God sometimes uses the completely inexplicable events in our lives to point us towards Him. We get to decide every time whether we'll lean in towards what is unfolding and say yes or back away. The folks who were following Jesus of Galilee got to decide the same thing every day because there was no roadmap, no program, and no certainty. All they had was this person, an idea, and an invitation to come and see. I like the passage in Scripture where God chooses Moses to lead. Moses puts up a fight, saying no one will follow him. God gives him three miracles to perform to establish confidence with his audience, but Moses protests again, saying he stutters and he can't speak, and asks God to please choose someone else. When Moses protests yet again, God gets a little angry and instructs Moses to take Aaron with him. I don't think it was because Moses needed Aaron, but because Moses mistakenly thought he had to be somebody important in order to be part of what God was going to do. I can relate. I'm the guy checking into my buddy's room to spend a bunch of his money on room service. Then I'm the guy who thinks he's being pranked. Then I'm the guy who thinks he's being asked to be a lawyer when he's really being asked to be a diplomat. Then I'm the guy who's sticking Ugandan flags in his car. Am I the right guy? I don't know. But I'm the guy being asked, and the last thing I want to do is miss an opportunity or make God mad, so I just keep saying yes. Maybe God's doing some inexplicable things in your life. Each of us gets to decide every time whether to lean in or step back, to say yes, ignore it, or tell God why he has the wrong person. There's this beautiful story in the Bible about a guy named Joseph that a friend of mine, Don, tells all the time. The story of Joseph has more turns in it than a mountain road in Colorado. It's an emotional roller coaster, but it ends up with Joseph being second in command in Egypt. And twice at the end of the book, Joseph says that the reason God put him where he did was so he could save many lives. And if you think about it, the reason God chose Moses was to save many lives. And the same goes for Jonah and Peter, all the apostles, and Jesus, and us too for that matter. We were all meant to save many lives. God is always trying to save lives, and it seems like he usually uses the least likely people to do it. So next time God asks you to do something that's completely inexplicable, something you're sure is a prank because it requires a decision or courage that's way over your pay grade, something that might even save lives, say yes. You never know. There might be some cool flags in it for you. Chapter 10. The Interview. I used to think I had to be someone important to accomplish things, but now I know Jesus uses ordinary people more. When the kids were growing up, we didn't have a television in the house connected to a cable or an antenna. If something bad happened in the world, I wanted the kids to hear about it from me. Whether it was news that the president had a girlfriend or that a plane hit a building, I thought the kids should hear about it from their parents. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, I rushed home before the kids left for school and gathered them around our dining room table and told them what had happened. Like everyone else, we struggled for words to describe to our kids why such a thing would occur. We talked about the presence of evil and the presence of good and how good ultimately wins. It was hard to really feel it, though, as I was mouthing the words. After talking for a while, I asked the kids this. If you had 5 minutes in front of a world leader, what would you ask them to help make sense of life, faith, hope, and the events that are unfolding around them? I admit it was a dorky dad thing to do, but I had each of them write down what they would ask on a piece of paper. Adam, who was 7 at the time, loved having people over to the house. I wasn't surprised when I saw Adam had written down that he would ask the world leaders if they wanted to come over to our house. When you're 7, there's nothing like having someone over to play, to get to know them better. Maybe, Adam thought, having the leaders over to the house could facilitate better understanding about each of these leaders and they would become better friends. I told Adam I thought it was a great idea, and he wrote it down on a piece of paper. Richard was next. He said he would ask each of the world leaders what they were hoping for. The idea was that if the world leaders knew what each other was hoping for, then perhaps they could start hoping for the same things. Rich reasoned that the problem was no one knew what other people were quietly hoping for. Richard's idea sounded super as well, so he wrote it down. Lindsay was the last to go and had listened to her brother's ideas. As the oldest, she was the precocious one and had written down her idea already, and I read it out loud. If the leaders wouldn't come over to our house for a visit, then what if she and her brothers went to their houses and asked them what they were hoping for? Even better, she had written, all 3 kids should do a video interview with the leaders so they could share it with all of the others. That way, each of these leaders would know what the others were hoping for and maybe find that they are hoping for the same things. I was amazed at what fantastic imaginations these kids had. They didn't even consider that what they were asking for was absurd or naive, or that they needed to be famous or powerful to ask these questions. Perhaps what the leaders would prefer was a few innocent kids asking innocent questions of them. I had the kids put their ideas in one letter. Then we downloaded the names of every president, prime minister, or dictator of every country in the world from the CIA website. We felt like we were hacking into NORAD. It was so cool. The information was all there. We just needed to figure out the addresses. The kids decided they didn't just want to write to a couple of the leaders. They wanted to write to all of them. Heck, why not give them all an equal shot at meeting these great kids, I thought. Next, we got a post office box, mostly because we didn't want Ahmadinejad knowing where we lived. Marie and I also made a deal with the kids. We told them that we'd mail all the letters, and if we got even a single yes from one of the world leaders to their request for a meeting, we'd take them. We mailed the letters, lots of them, hundreds and hundreds of them. We waited a week or two, and then every day after school, we would check the kids' post office box for any mail. It wasn't long before responses started coming. It was slow at first, maybe 1 or 2 a day, but then dozens started streaming in every day from all over the globe. We got a small globe of the planet Earth and stuck a pin in every country whose leader responded. It wasn't long before our little Earth was peppered with hundreds of pins and looked like it was undergoing serious acupuncture treatments. Pretty much every letter the kids received back said thanks, but no thanks. But the wording was so eloquent that it still made the kids feel great. Law school admissions offices could learn a thing or two from these guys. For instance, Tony Blair, Prime Minister of England at the time, handwrote something to the effect of, "Jolly good idea about the meeting." He still said no, but it was cool knowing he at least thought it was a nice idea. None of us were sure what jolly good meant exactly, but the kids guessed it must have something to do with saying no. From then on, when I asked them to do their homework or the dishes, they would just say, "Jolly good." It was a Tuesday like every other day, and after school the kids and I swung by the post office to pick up their mail. They came springing out of the door of the post office like they always did, with a wad of letters wrapped in a huge rubber band. They jumped in the car and divided the letters between them in the back seat. There were several more no's, but also a letter from the State House of Bulgaria. They opened it up together and started reading. Then came a shriek, and from somewhere in the back seat, the words that changed everything. "We're invited to the palace to meet." The kids roared in unison. "Of course you are," I answered. A day or two later, an envelope from the Prime Minister of Switzerland arrived, inviting them to Bern with the same invitation. Then a letter from the president of Israel inviting the kids to come to Jerusalem. Over the following weeks, they didn't just get one yes, they got 29. Maria and I didn't know what to do, so we did the best thing we could think of. We began a family training program to spruce up on our manners. One of the yeses came from a real live prince, so we taught the kids how to bow and to curtsy too. Maria and I had a promise to keep to the kids, so we told the school that we were pulling them out for a grand caper. Some of their teachers had a cow when we said how long we'd be gone and wrote me a letter about it. I opened it, wrote tough on it, and sent it back, and we left. Now, if a leader were talking to a grown-up like me, they would talk about boring things like having more jobs, gross domestic product, better schools, and more roads. You know, that kind of stuff crafted for public consumption. But they weren't talking to me. They were talking to our kids. Sweet Maria and I were just roadies carrying the cameras. What would happen more often than not is that the kids would begin in an official reception room and have an